Welcome to Mindset 52 Podcast, your source for powerful strategies and uplifting stories from top-tier achievers, athletes, entrepreneurs, and industry visionaries. Discover how they thrive in their fields while staying true to what really matters: personal well-being and family. Immerse yourself in their transformative insights and step closer to your highest potential. This is Mindset 52. Here we go.
Welcome everyone to Mindset 52 Podcast with JR Rivera. I have today Shiva Prabhu. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Prabhu.
Prabhu. That's fine, yeah. Well, thank you so much, Shiva, for joining me today on Mindset 52. Really excited to have you on the podcast today, man.
No, thanks for the invitation.
100%. There's so much to talk about today, and you know, we don't have a whole lot of time, but I did want to start off right away with getting a little bit of a background story. You're a medical doctor, medical physician, gastroenterologist?
Yep. You got it.
All right. I struggled with that one. I had to practice a couple of times.
GI, doc. You can say
GI.
That.
Okay.
Yeah.
So such a big, important part of the whole, you know, system, the whole human body, right?
Yeah.
One of the biggest talking points, I think, recently, especially on social media, there's a lot going on social media, but I feel like it's one of the biggest topics right now on the platforms. And I kind of wanted to get into that. But before, how did you grow up? Did you grow up here in Omaha? Or tell me a little bit about you growing up.
Yeah, I was born in Iowa, but I lived most of my life here in Omaha, Nebraska. My parents were immigrants to this country, so I'm kind of first generation, born and raised in the United States. So that's been a unique experience for me and the background of my family. But yeah, I've lived here since I was five. You know, went to elementary school, middle school, high school here in Omaha, got the chance to go away for college, came back to do my medical school and training, and then left again for almost 9 years to do kind of the medical specialty and subspecialty training out in Salt Lake City, Utah, which is a beautiful place to be.
And I hear a lot about
kind of miss it a lot in terms of the natural beauty and the outdoors, and the weather. Weather's a little bit nicer than here. But ultimately, family is kind of what drew us back to Omaha. My wife and I, our parents are here, raising our kids around grandparents. Experience I never had, as our family was kind of scattered all over the world, essentially, sure. Has been really important to us.
What nationality are your parents?
We're Indian origin, so my grandparents are all from India. My parents actually grew up in Africa, were born and raised in Africa. And then my dad ended up in Canada. My mom was in England for a long time doing school, and then they met and ended up in Iowa City, Iowa, of all places.
What a journey.
Yeah.
I mean, it just goes to show the human nature of moving around the world and, you know, and somehow finding a way.
Yeah.
So did they know each other, they meet later on?
Yeah, family connections, you know, in the Indian culture, arranged marriage is a big deal.
But yeah.
They were the only people in their family that didn't have an arranged marriage. They had what's called a love marriage, which we think of in today's society as normal. That's what we do. We meet somebody, fall in love based on common interests. And in a lot of cultures, that's not how it is.
Yeah.
So again, it's just they had a unique journey, and I certainly have as well.
Phenomenal. So, you know, you grew up here in Omaha, growing up with your parents. And
yeah.
Growing up here, did you right away, did you think that you were going to be a doctor? Is that what you wanted to be growing up? Or?
I think we're all shaped by our influences. And
sure.
My dad, you know, is my hero, and he's a scientist. He has a PhD, so he has a doctorate in kind of research. So he has a lab at the University Medical Center, but isn't a medical doctor. So science was always a big deal to us. And, you know, the typical Indian immigrant family is you got to grow up to be a doctor or some other professional. So that was an expectation, I think, that was, and then the interest of science kind of grew as I got older. Something that I always knew I was interested in, but it's a journey. It's not like you snap your fingers and you're
right.
A doctor. So it was a process for sure.
So you're an ambitious kid. I mean, right off the bat, you got into tennis.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, so that was another passion of my dad's. Is he loves tennis.
And
so
he plays tennis.
He plays. He watches. He
That's
just
awesome.
Consumes everything about it. So as a little kid, I had a tennis racket in my hand, and we were always out on the court. And, you know, in elementary school, middle school, kind of developed into a passion of mine as well. So I started getting playing competitively, traveling to tournaments, practicing, you know, every day.
And how old were you at this point?
I would say elementary school.
Oh, wow. So you were taking it serious as a kid.
Summers were, you know, from 10 onwards were pretty much spent traveling around the region, playing tournaments. And I would have to find people to play with. And so a lot of times I'm a 10, 11, 12-year-old kid playing adults, essentially.
Just smoking with people.
Trying to your age group, probably. So, you know, tennis was a big shaper in my life for sure. And then it eventually got to a point where I became good enough and I was getting some scholarship offers to play college tennis. And that's what ended me up at Notre Dame. Never would have dreamed of going there or been able to go there, frankly, without tennis.
That's awesome. So it reminded me of Notre Dame, the Fighting Irish, right?
Fighting Irish,
holy crap. So right off the bat, you were competitive with it. And then you said you went to state a couple of times in high school?
I won the Nebraska State Championships twice. When you play some of these national tournaments over the summer, you kind of get some exposure to college coaches. Academics was always a big thing.
Sure.
So as we were making our list, it was kind of like, all right, what's a good blend of high-level academics that can help you achieve your life goals, as well as a good environment to help, you know, develop tennis and take that wherever it can go. And I got really lucky at Notre Dame. The coach was an older guy. He had been at the Naval Academy for 10 years. He was in his 50s, maybe 60s at the time that I was there. So he was like another father figure, had very high standards and, you know, taught me a lot about life. And then, you know, you have a team. There's 10, 12 guys that become your brothers and are still some of my best friends today. Fun experience.
Those people that help support those fundamentals, mm-hmm. I feel they're just crucial.
Yep.
You know, talk about the nature, nurture, aspect of life and how that nurture is so important. Yep. You know, having those individuals that are rocks and just can continue to push you,
and
in the right direction.
Going through things together. And, I was the only one on the team that was pursuing science or medicine. A lot of people do business or mm-hmm. finance or some other things. So that was a challenge to balance the academic load as well as the tennis. But it was one of the best experiences of my life for sure.
So this series, Minds of 52, is surrounded around the word balance and what that means to you. Now, of course, balance, it probably differs from a Shiva that was, 19, 20, 21, 100%. And now, obviously. So there's a big difference in what that means. What do you remember about balance at that time, since you were handling so much?
Yeah.
Not that you're not now, but.
No, balance is a moving target, and I'm not sure we ever get it completely right. It's always easier to see things from retrospect, but life is lived forward. And so I think you realize you made some mistakes, you erred on one side or the other always, but you're always doing your best to try to juggle it. Our coach used to say you can major in three things, academics, tennis, or your social life, but you can only actually do two of them successfully. And so what are you going to do? So it's kind of a good grounding principle mm-hmm. to remember, like, yeah, I probably can't live the same way some of my roommates that didn't have all the obligations that I had. I can't do all the things they're doing. But it's trade-offs, and you decide what's important to you.
Well, definitely a trade-off. There's so many different ways that you can approach it, but having that mental, that's a good way to put it. You can only realistically pick two, especially to be at that level, because there's so much that is involved. Mm-hmm. The academic side, all the homework, all the work, all the just the keeping up with everything, and obviously, being an athlete, that's its own thing. Now, do you think that kind of balanced the repetition, maybe the disciplines, kind of helped with the other side?
100%. I love sports, and I think, the competitive sports landscape for kids now is a whole nother topic that we don't need to go into. But the lessons that I learned and the structure, the discipline, and the work that goes into it are things that I was able to translate into later on when I went to medical school, residency, fellowship, and even now in my life, you know, in terms of reminding myself what's important and, you know, what I need, what my family needs. These are things that are just timeless lessons that I learned over those years.
Yeah. Sure. Now, there's always a sense of what you are and how you grow up, what lessons you take on. And I think the difference, the fine-tuning, those little fine-tuning of principles that you want to now relay over to your kids. Now, your kids are a little bit younger, right?
Yeah, they're 4.5 and 2.5.
4.5, so you're probably not telling them, all right, discipline, you know, but that is, you know, in the horizon. That is something sure. that will start being implemented by just regular tasks and activities. Mm-hmm. Do you have something right now that you're starting to already implement? I just maybe regular schedules and stuff like that that you might
have them? Yeah, and I think anybody with kids kind of knows they thrive on schedules, and maybe it's more me and my wife that thrive on schedules and they just follow the lead.
Maybe just to keep your sanity.
Yeah, but I would say little things that we do, saying a prayer at night, you know, cadences of our household, things we do at dinner time. That we think are important. We try to make habits. We're not sure if they're sinking in. And then, you know, a kid will be like, hey, we forgot to do this tonight. And it's just a reminder that they're always listening. And
that feels good.
It's always coming in there, no matter how little they are. I think that those routines are important.
Yeah. I think they definitely resonate within all the memories that are, mm-hmm. are being built throughout life. But, and man, gosh, does that go fast? I feel like, you know, my kids are 11 and 6 now, but I feel like just a blink of an eye ago, they were, you know, just tiny, you know, it's insane. So, creating more and more of those little constant memories, I feel that, you know, they'll pop up in our heads mm-hmm. a little bit later. We're almost creating more for us, I feel like, than for them.
100%. Yep. Parenting has been the biggest self-development, I think, more than I ever realized. Yeah.
Now, we were in Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. You're kicking ass over there. You're doing amazing things out there and learning a lot, probably learning a lot about yourself, learning about discipline, and balancing everything that you were going through on both sides of the spectrum, being an athlete, trying to be a professional at that point. You weren't in medical school yet, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, I had a good career. I was pretty successful. I think what people would say, maximize my potential at Notre Dame and really maximize my opportunities there. And I had a chance to play minor league professional tennis afterwards. And that was one time where I could say, all right, well, I've had to balance these things. Mm-hmm. Now I get to go kind of all in and really see where I can take it and do this full time. And so I did that for about a year and a half after I graduated from college. And that was a fantastic experience. Just
how was that? How did that go?
So, I mean, it's tough. You hear a lot of stories about minor league baseball and how it's just kind of like you're living on a shoestring and you're just waiting for that, you know, opportunity. And that's a lot like the tennis world. You make your own schedule. You're traveling by yourself. You're finding guys that are going to the same tournament. You're sharing hotel rooms. You're sharing shuttles to the practice courts. You're playing in front of me. You know, you're lucky if you get 20, 30 people watching some of these small tournaments. So it's a grind is the best way I can describe it. And it really makes you decide how bad you want it, how much you're going to put in that extra work, how much you're just going to take it easy, take a day off here and there. So it was fantastic.
No guidance at all. You're just making it happen.
Because if you need a coach, if you need this, that, the other, you're paying for it. And you're making enough money to make it to the next week. You're not making money when you're, you know, 500 in the world doing this. So I wouldn't trade it for the world. It was awesome. But by the time I got to that end of that year and a half or so, it was kind of out of my system. I realized, hey, I did this. I had this experience. I love tennis. I still love tennis, but I'm not. I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. Yeah. And that's where I was really thankful for that foundation of, you know, that balance in college, the influence of my parents, kind of directing me and making sure I always knew what I was going to do long term. And so, you know, medical school was not a fallback plan. It was the plan.
It was the plan.
But this was kind of like a fun detour.
Yeah.
When I got to medical school, I felt like I had had an experience that a lot of people hadn't had. You know, most people were going from college to medical school, staying in that grind, that academic grind the whole time. And I had this whole different experience and set of things that I got to do and experience. So, you know, I felt like that made me a better rounded medical student and now a better rounded, you know, physician.
That's phenomenal. So that's where you now pivoted towards full time.
Yep.
Going, you then that's when you moved to Utah, right?
So we moved to I moved to Omaha because okay. I went to medical school. So medical school is 4 years.
Yeah.
And no tennis pretty much that time. I maybe taught a little bit on the side for some money, but otherwise it was 100% school. Kind of dove into that, and that was a total different type of grind and very unglamorous as well. Yeah. Lots of late nights and. And that's where that discipline, that's where those the mindset, the goals, the, you know, that kind of came into play. And it was easier for me to do that after having that other experience of like going out on the tour and trying to play these tournaments and do something yeah. different that I knew I wanted to be there. And I was committed to doing it. And it made all that work a lot easier.
So it's a higher level of discipline at this point. Now it's more focused into the medical field. Obviously balance changes then. Mm-hmm. Now you're focusing on that
yep.
and solely that. At what point did you meet your wife? Was then?
About second year of medical school.
Okay. Here in Omaha.
Yep. And we started dating. She's from Omaha as well. She had left for college and ran track and cross country and had come back kind of similar story to me. So we were had similar experiences with athletics, had grown up very similarly, but didn't know each other at all in high school and just had an immediate connection. We're going through a lot of the same things in medical school. That's when after medical school, we got married. We moved to Utah together. We did our internal medicine training together. And so I would say that was one of the best things that ever happened to me in my life, obviously meeting her. And then being able to go through those hard things together.
Because yeah.
those are brutal training. You know, you're working 80 hours a week. You're trying to do research on top of that to get into some of these more competitive subspecialty fields. Having somebody that understands what you're going through, that's going through it with you. You can come home and decompress and they actually understand what you're talking about.
Yep.
And having that balance. And it was just us at that time. And it was fantastic.
Now, I do think that probably is such a huge add-on or I guess plus having that other individual understand, because sometimes there is a little bit of a separation
yep.
and maybe even a difference in thinking on, you know, on career journeys. And sometimes that puts pressures mm-hmm. on the partners, you know, and that can cause a little bit of an issue. Sometimes a lot of it, you know, of an issue. So yep. You know, balance is all about what you perceive it as. And I think everyone can come up with some kind of consensus of what that means for them. But if you are both struggling through the same stuff, you guys are all both so committed into your journeys, you understand each other better. And I feel like you can find support with totally. Each other a little bit better.
Totally.
Do you think that kind of prepared you a little bit better now to having, you know, now kids and, you know, everything that you're going through now?
100%. I think, you know, we were always on the same page. We were always supportive of each other's goals and what we wanted to do after residency. And, you know, it's definitely a journey. There's lots of decisions to make, but there's big chunks of time that you have to commit to do some of these, the different training and things like that. And so to have somebody that's 100% supportive, to be able to support them in the same way and be speaking the same language, be going through the same things, was hugely helpful. You know, everybody's balance is different. And so there's a lot of people that we met that were like, I couldn't handle it if my spouse was in medicine. Like, I want to go home and I want to just be done with it and leave it at the door and not talk about medicine or about my day at all. And I think there's some value in that too. I think everybody's a little different. They like to, you know, have that separation. For us, it worked great. You know, we were able to know what we were going through, to know the frustrations, the highs and the lows. And so it's really, it's molded us into who we are for sure.
Yeah. You know, I guess one question before we get into a little bit more higher topic there, but you guys are there. You're not the same kind of specialty, right?
Correct. Yeah. So after our residency got over, you can stop and you can do internal medicine, and that you can do either outpatient or inpatient, which is called hospitalist medicine. Mm-hmm. And that's what she did. And she supported me in continuing my training, and I did another 3 years to train to be a gastroenterologist.
How much school did you do, man?
Too many years. So it was another 3 years, but luckily we got to stay in Salt Lake City. And that was a whole other competitive process. You know, there's 1,000 applications for 3 spots to stay at the University of Utah. People are trying to get there from all over the place. So we were lucky that we got to stay there. She was able to work, kind of be done with training and start working and actually earning money. I was in training again for another 3 years. She was 100% supportive through that. And then after I got done with training was when we, you know, started thinking about starting a family and things like that.
You know, I know, I guess you realize that with the medical field, there's a light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to financial.
Yeah.
Alleviation, like being at a good spot, you know. But at what point do you start making money? Is it typically once you are
committed after medical school? So you start it, but it's like, you know, 50, 60 a year. And in the context of student loans that you have to take out for medical school, it's not much. You're barely covering the interest. So it's after residency when you kind of are done with training, or after your fellowship, when you actually get your big boy job.
Yeah. It's a big journey, big journey there. So now, you know, you have, both of you have, you know, your own jobs here in Omaha. Yep. What made you move back here as a family for the most part?
Yeah.
Get everything kind of situated back in Omaha and establish a family here?
Yeah, this was a journey because it wasn't our intention at first. We loved Salt Lake. We had built a good community of friends, and Rachel loved her job. I had a good support system at the university.
The weather.
So I stayed on after my fellowship. I started my first real job as faculty, as an assistant professor at the University of Utah, with the intention of just staying there, teaching, being involved in the GI department there. And, you know, she really liked her job in Salt Lake. We had our first baby right in the middle of COVID, July of 2020. So that was a crazy experience in and of itself. Then about a year after that, I got a phone call out of the blue. We were on vacation from somebody here in Omaha that knew me, actually tennis connection.
Oh, wow.
You know, word of mouth, knew I had gotten into GI, and just kind of inquiring, like, hey, would you ever be interested in moving back to Omaha? And our knee jerk was, no, we love it in Salt Lake. We just bought a house this year, and we're not going to move.
Mm-hmm.
But we're back in town for our daughter's first birthday to celebrate with grandparents. I'll at least meet and talk about, you know, what it is. For me professionally, that was a big switch. I had joined a university system, which is this huge enterprise consisting of all the different specialties. Research, teaching is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And coming to Omaha, I was joining a private practice group where it's independent gastroenterologists that had kind of formed their own group, providing services to the community, but no teaching, no research, just kind of clinical care 100%. So it was it was a lot different in terms of practice style, practice management, volume. You know, in an academic center, traditionally you don't see as many patients, you're not kind of pushed to be as productive.
Sure.
Whereas in a private practice, it's bottom line, like, how many patients are you seeing, and
so you're in essence almost running a business as well.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, okay,
and perfect. So that was a new experience to learn about. But I think after thinking about it, talking about it, I think for our family, it made 100% sense, you know, and for me professionally, it was a great opportunity. I get to grow and learn about a whole different side of medicine, the business side of medicine, in addition to kind of like growing my skills. And it was a challenge for sure. When we moved, Rachel was pregnant with our second. It was January, everybody got COVID. It was just a thing. So not without its ups and downs for sure. Yeah. But now we've been here 3 years. I'm loving it. I'm loving it. And we look back and we call this home for sure. Now we have a soft spot in our heart for Salt Lake, but this is home.
What a journey. I have to say, you know, those little bits of adversity you're talking about, you know, baby being born right during COVID and then a baby being born right when you're moving in January, everybody, yeah. You know, these are kinds of things that, number one, they're memories again. They become, you know, those staple for what you went through. And then also they grow a little bit of callus, you know, for later situations that were, of course, you know, life throws at you.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing a whole lot. How does Sheba now take on balance with family, with everything going on, yeah. with being a business owner, being doing everything that you're doing now?
Yeah, it's a moving target, and I think it's I'm learning about it every day. I don't think I'm perfect, and I definitely haven't been perfect at it. But I think we're learning together. I'm grateful to have like the most supportive spouse to kind of like be that balance that you can talk to and say, what am I deficient in? What am I lacking? You know, I think a lot of people who are high achievers who want to get stuff done, sleep is one of those first things to go, right? It's like, well, I'll just get up earlier. I'll just stay up later. I'll just get this done and I'll come through for people. And for me, it's been a journey. An inward journey. I don't think it's anything you can look outward for. Really realizing what's important to you, where are your values at? What do you need?
That needs to go on a T-shirt. It's an inward journey. I love that. Yeah, I love that.
It's 100% like learning about yourself and why you're doing some of these things. I think as you go through all the things that I went through in my life, at some point, maybe you're looking for praise or a pat on the back and you're kind of being a little performative in terms of achieving.
True.
And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, that's not going to really fill your bucket. You know, it's those things that are important to you. And so I think having kids has just completely changed our mindset and changed our priorities and really made us think more about the future and the now. And how to really enjoy those moments, because you're right, it does go so fast. Even our kids are little. You were talking about your kids are a little bit older, but our kids seem big compared to what they were 2 years ago.
And they just go so fast.
Really trying to appreciate those moments, value those moments, and learn what we need to be the best parents to show up for them every day, be the best spouse you can be the best physician I can be the best parent I can be.
I love that. I'm still stuck on that phrase that you said. It's an inward journey because it really is. There's nowhere else to look for. Really, the first place you got to look is to yourself and how you can improve, how you can develop. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, nothing else really moves. I wanted to get a little bit deeper into the whole conversation with, I guess, the GI world.
Yeah.
If I'm going to call it GI because otherwise I'll get tongue-tied on the whole word. But there's a lot of conversation on social media, and I think a lot of it's because of misinformation or the ease of information, mm-hmm. and sometimes a little bit of fear-mongering, you know, from mm-hmm. certain sites and all that. What can you say as far as, I guess, problems in today's society that you've seen maybe grown or something that you're seeing that's something pretty prevalent maybe amongst younger people or something that you've seen as a big problem right now?
Yeah. You know, when I got into GI, I got into it because it was a good mix of medicine and procedural based. And I think now practicing GI and actually the people that I'm seeing and the complaints that they have or the symptoms that they have has opened my eyes to, it's everywhere. And everybody's got some gut issues of some sort, whether it be stomach, liver, colon, you know, we deal with it all. I think the biggest thing that I try to get across to my patients is that it's so multifactorial, and the food system and what we're putting into our bodies is a huge deal out there these days. And I think that it is something that does need to change and people just need to be aware of, because I think that a lot of these things haven't been studied and we don't know what they're doing to our kids, to us as we get older. And there's a lot of things that we allow in our country that other countries don't allow. So
it's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And, what are some of those things that you're specifically?
You know, dyes, ultra-processed foods, additives, artificial sweeteners. These are things that, you know, we don't know yet in medicine the definitive endpoints. And that's the really hard thing, is that there's a lot of uncertainty in medicine. And living with that uncertainty is difficult. And so trying to convey to people, like, here's the best evidence we have, and here's what I know, but also there's this big gray area. And so I think that that's led to a lot of people just completely distrusting sometimes the medical establishment and being like, you don't really know what you're talking about. I think nobody really knows what they're talking about. We're learning, and as more research comes, like, I can't wait to learn more about the microbiome of the gut and how that can affect. But right now, we don't have a lot of good tools to test for that. I have people come in every day that talk about that and how they can make it healthy, and should I take this prebiotic or probiotic? And we just don't know. And I think having some of that humbleness to say, like, we're learning about it, we don't know, you got to listen to your own body, and you got to try to be as informed as possible. You don't need to go off the deep end and listen to certain people that are saying, like, burn everything. But there is a balance. And I think certainly we've kind of veered off to the side. And, you know, that's been a journey for us too, because it's so easy to get food and to eat things and not to be mindful about what you're doing. And especially with little kids, we've been trying to, and I've learned a lot, not only as a GI doctor, but as a parent, about, yeah, it does really matter what's going into your body and how that can affect not only symptoms, but maybe even long-term disease.
You know, I think there's so many different diets out there, and people with their own ideas and their own, if the medical field doesn't know, you know, what lets some of those people know, think that they know. But let's start off by some of those, and I kind of want to get your opinion on some of them, or if at the end of the day it's all about balance again. But there's, you know, very plant-based, very meat-based diets. There are organic diets. There are paleo diets. Do you think there's something that actually makes more sense? Or is it just whole foods, organic foods, and just simple is better?
Well, I think it depends. And again, like, that's that, you know, everybody wants that answer. Like, what's the best diet? You know, the best diet is what you can stick to and what makes your body feel good. I think everybody is a little different. I think, yeah, in general, we should be eating more fruits and whole fruits and vegetables. We should be eating less processed foods. But am I, like, going to say you can never eat red meat or you got to go plant-based completely? I don't think we know yet. And I think there's a lot of people that have a lot of success on either ends of those spectrums. So, and I think as we learn more about what's happening in our bodies, how our microbiomes, how it's affecting our mood, our metabolic health, our, you know, all these other things that we don't think of as connected to our gut, I think we'll learn a lot more. But I think the biggest thing is less processed foods, more whole foods. When you read that label, if they're the less extra things less that you items. Can't, you know, you can't pronounce or you don't really know why it's in there, trying to cut some of that stuff out.
Oh my gosh, some of that stuff on there, it's just like, what could this possibly be? Yeah. Like, there's 20 letters in this word.
Yeah, and we all know this, right? We eat certain things and we're not full and we feel more hungry and it might give us some gut issues too, and you know that. But that's not for everybody.
Yeah.
And so it's a very personal thing. And I think we're learning more, you know, in the medical world about how to advise patients. But there is no one size fits all.
And talking about that distrust, I think there's definitely that feeling of the big food, you know, and these companies almost antagonizing or purposely putting some of these chemicals to make us want to eat more of them, you know, whether it's the sugars or these dyes that make us feel different. You know, there's a big communication link, isn't there, from 100%. Your gut to your brain.
100%. I deal with the gut-brain axis, and I try to counsel patients all the time about this. And a lot of it is, you know, profit-driven. These are companies, they're trying to make money, they're trying to sell more food, they want people to buy more food. And I love that there's a lot of information out there, and I love that people are getting more educated about it. And so I try to meet people where they're at. You know, sometimes people come at me with pretty crazy beliefs or ideas about something they read, and I try not to ever be dismissive, because I think that there's probably some truth in everything that they're reading, and in their experience is always different than other people that I've worked with. So, again, that's been a big area of growth for me, trying to stay humble in that and let people know that I don't know. And that somebody tells you they do know, they're probably lying to you.
Oh, that's powerful. Probiotics. What are your thoughts on probiotics and in that world?
I think that in the future we're going to be able to target probiotics. We're going to be able to measure JR's microbiome, know what you're deficient in or what you have too much of, and know the probiotic that's going to be perfect for your gut, that's going to help you align your gut, that's going to help your mood, going to help your energy, going to help your metabolic health, going to help you lose weight if that's what you want to do, whatever. But right now, I don't think we have that. So I think we see commercials and we're like, oh, yeah, they say it's good for your gut. I'm like, well, who says?
Right.
You know, and who knows your gut health and what that means. I don't think they're harmful. But I just don't think they have all the benefits yet because we haven't been able to personalize it.
So there's still a lot of unknown, a lot of, I guess,
a lot of room for growth.
A lot of room
for growth. And that's what's cool about the GI field is that people are interested in it, and everybody's got something that they like, I can't eat that, or this happens when, you know, so everybody's got a GI story.
That's what I was going to tell you. The next things I'm hearing so much hype about, you know, all my friends getting these food sensitivity tests and what that really means. I feel like there's maybe not the whole story there. Could you shed some light on some of that?
Similar thing where, you know, it's not a true allergy a lot of the times because allergies are a little bit easier to diagnose, but food insensitivities, definitely a thing. Don't have really good tests yet. A lot of times, unfortunately, it is trial and error. You know, and in our world, a lot of times we're dealing with people that might have an autoimmune disease like celiac disease, which is your body actually responding against and creating antibodies against gluten. But it's super popular to go gluten-free because it's healthy. And that's not always the case, but there are people who don't have celiac disease, have a gluten sensitivity, have realized that through trial and error, and trying to, you know, reassure them that, yeah, you might not have celiac disease, but you should avoid gluten. Doesn't mean gluten's some terrible thing for you or for everybody. A lot of people eat gluten and they're just fine. So living in that uncertainty and that there's nothing that's like, you know, terrible for you right out of the bat, and that we're learning a lot and we're progressing.
Now, there's another conversation a little bit about colon cancer in younger patients. Is that something that you're seeing?
Oh, yeah. So they changed the guidelines a few years ago. It used to be 50 that you got to start doing that screening for colorectal cancer. They changed that to 45 because there has been an increase in younger people getting diagnosed with colon cancer. You know, when we look at big populations, we see this trend of like a westernized diet being introduced and all of a sudden the rates of colon cancer increasing.
Oh, wow.
So you see, you know, Asian countries that might have had certain diets that get westernized and get some of these large food companies coming in and providing a lot more food, and there's an increase in the incidence of colon cancer.
So there's some correlation there.
There's some correlation, and we don't know what it is, and a lot of people think it's related to these ultra processed foods or the additives and these things. And so, I see a lot of, you know, 45 year olds that are asymptomatic coming in and getting their screening. That's something that we definitely support. And then if you're having any type of symptoms, even if you're younger, unfortunately we have to diagnose cancer in people in their 30s and 40s. Wow. And it's just a reality. And everybody wants to know what they can do to reduce their risk. And again, we don't know, but I think eating whole foods, you know, there's a link with exercise, there's a link with not smoking, you know, there's all these little things you can do to just promote your general health that also seem to reduce the risk of colon cancer.
So just to reiterate, what's the new age to
45?
Yep. Okay.
And that's any type of screening. You know, for us, that's colonoscopy because we're able to find these kind of precancerous growths and remove them at the time of the procedure.
Yeah.
But there's other things like Cologuard and, you know, there's a lot of things out there that you can do to get screened. But yeah, 45 is the guideline.
Going back to that, is it gut mind access or what it was called?
Gut brain access.
How do you think that also stress and maybe our society culture of stress, high level, maybe, I don't know, just society in general, the way we live, how does that affect everything else?
It's linked. It's 100% linked. And it's amazing how many people come into my office and say, like, I have these symptoms, and they definitely get worse when I get stressed. And I think it's, you know, back to what we were talking about, balance. You know, what's off balance? Are you not sleeping? Are you way overstressed at work? What's going on in your personal life? Like, it's all these other things that sometimes we fix those things, and the gut issues are just a symptom of the imbalance in your life, whether it's what you're eating or, you know, not exercising or some of these other things that happen. It's amazing. And again, I can't point to a certain neurotransmitter like serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine or all these things that are implicated, but they all, they get out of whack and they tell our brain. And I think at some point we know it and we feel it and we don't feel like we're doing something right. And it manifests in these physical symptoms.
It's almost like your body has an alarm system that mm-hmm. just let you know, stop it.
Yeah.
Do
yeah.
something different.
Cut it out. Yeah. But and unfortunately, a lot of people don't want to hear that. They want to hear that quick fix. They want to hear, can't you just give me a pill? Can't you just tell me I have a food sensitivity and then I'll stop eating this and I'll go on and I'll be better? But I think it's not that easy.
Matt, do you think that there's also a little bit of a culture thing in the medical field of having that as more of a solution rather than like, well, maybe you should look at what you're doing, you know? And
for sure. Our medical training, I mean, we get such little training about sleep and addiction and even exercise. We all know it's important, but like, how do you counsel somebody to really improve that? And in modern medicine, you're not necessarily compensated for that. You're running a business and you're not compensated to spend 30 minutes talking to somebody about their sleep and exercise, but that's the most important thing that they could probably do to improve their health. So it's a balance to try to remind people of that, and also be efficient in practicing kind of the guideline-based medicine of what we actually do know, ruling out some of the bad things, like I was talking about, autoimmune diseases, infections, all these other things that can cause these similar symptoms. So I see that as my primary job, ruling out some of these like organic diseases that have a quick fix or a treatment that we do and people feel better. And then once we get to the end of that rope, then I spend that time and try to guide them to resources, whether that be, I mean, sometimes it's therapy, sometimes it's even medicines that kind of change that gut-brain axis that are traditionally thought of as antidepressants. Like, you don't think of GI doctors prescribing those, but it's a big part of my practice because something's out of balance and somebody, and sometimes they need something to help as they change their lifestyle.
I'm so happy you're approaching it so openly, because that's such a, I think, fundamental part of our society right now, that we want to blame something and we don't want to blame ourselves. And sometimes our own actions and our own habits and our own lifestyles can affect us the most than anything else that's exterior. So, 100%. Dr. Sheba Parbu.
Yep.
I said it right. Yeah, okay, perfect. Yep. Thank you so much for being on. Thank you for your transparency. Thank you for your time. And we'll have to run it back, do another episode, because there's so much more that I want to ask you.
I'll be here.
But I know we're in a hurry. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Appreciate you being on
the podcast. Thanks for having me.